You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Well, hello and welcome to TFM's local books and comic show for Star Trek. And that's right, I'm back and I'm helping to host this week. And I'm so excited that Jonathan is here with me as well.
Thank you so much. We have a very great, excellent topic to talk about today.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Because it's New Book Day.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
And it's always great when you have a new book that delivers so much. It's just so exciting. Because sometimes, especially with these franchises, when you wait for so long, if you have a disappointing book, it's like, oh, man, I waited so long for this. But this is an example of we waited so long and we got this book.
Yes, that's fantastic. I'm so excited to talk to Dayton about Pliable Truths. Before we get into everything, of course, you can find the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and we would appreciate it if you would subscribe and let people know that you're listening to the episodes by sharing us out on social media. Of course, we're on X Twitter at Trek FM. We also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We're on Instagram at Trek FM. You can find the listeners only discussion group called the Babel Conference on Facebook under that title. Just search for it. You'll find us. You can join. And also, you can become a patron of the network over at Patreon, patreon.com/TrekFM, like our associate producers, Casey Pettit, as well as Greg Rosier. Both of them support the network over on Patreon and have chosen Literary Treks as the show to be an associate producer of. And if you like all that we're doing, we could absolutely use your help. So go over there and do that. And of course, maybe if you're on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, give us star ratings and reviews and help people find the show as well. But, Jonathan, this is one of those episodes where I feel like it's really not worth us just kind of beating around the bush. Maybe it's just time that we head over to the feature and let Dayton out of the green room finally.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We'll let him out of the green room. And in this case, he is in a green room.
Well, Jonathan, I am just so excited because, you know, one of the best parts of this show, we say it every time, is when we get the opportunity to talk to the authors about the books that have come out. And we have a brand new book that has just dropped by Dayton Ward, Pliable Truths, which is almost like a TNG / Deep Space Nine book. It's like the prequel we never knew we always wanted. We never knew we always wanted this, but we wanted it because it's great. And Dayton has now filled in a story between the end of what happens there on TNG, of bridging that gap into Deep Space Nine. And Dayton, it's always fantastic to get you out of the green room and into an actual chair.
Well, how are you guys doing this evening?
Doing great, man. Doing great.
Thank you for having me back again. I don't remember. I quit counting. How many times I've done this with people. So
we've got to be up there in the terms of the repeat interviews.
I know I was the first, I was among the first, if not the first, but I don't remember that far back. And I know that sounds crazy, but I'm just getting older, so it's hard to remember all the details.
It was the Voyager novella, I think.
Yeah, no, not Voyager. It was
not Voyager. Vanguard. Yes. Vanguard. That's what I meant to say.
Yeah, and
yeah, so that's 2012. So that's 12 years. We're
very
talking
first
about
episode. Dayton Ward, was amazing. Yeah. You kicked off this show, and the fact that obviously you're doing something right because they keep asking you back, and so this we ask every author who comes on about this. And with this story, you know, again, you're taking all the elements that had been there for TNG and the ones that they were using to set up Deep Space Nine and putting that into a story that basically gives us the prequel to Emissary. And so where did you guys come up with this idea of like, this is a story that does need to be told?
Well, thank you. I don't know if it needed to be told, but it's the one that ended up being told because I was approached by my editors at Simon & Schuster, and they said, we want you to write a next generation novel that crosses with Deep Space Nine, and we would like you to set it during television series, the next generation television series. And I said, well, okay, that narrows the window considerably right off the bat, right? And so I start putting it together and figuring out where the crossing lines are. And I'm like, you know, Worf doesn't even know anybody among the DS9 Starfleet crew until he gets there in season 4 of DS9, which is set after Generations and after the Enterprise D crashes. And right. So automatically we're starting to like winnow down what my, where the gaps are or where the opportunities are to cross these people over. So right away I know that if I'm going to create a story set during the Next Generation series, I have to find something for Worf to do that doesn't allow him to interact with anybody from the station because he hasn't met anybody. I mean, I watched Way of the Warrior a couple of times just to make sure. And he's getting introduced to people in different scenes. So it's like, well, okay, he can't talk to Kira. He can't talk to Odo. He can't talk, you know, I'm like, so what am I going to do? So as we started figuring out where the gaps were, I realized I was leaning toward the time period right after Picard was tortured in Chain of Command, which is not that far timeline wise before Emissary. So there's my gap. And so I pitched that idea and I said, I think I can tell a story in here, maybe deal with post-traumatic stress, maybe deal with the fallout from the Bajoran, from the Cardassian occupation, and I'll flesh out some subplots and we'll see where we can go. And that's where the idea for the prison camp planet came from. I needed a whole other B plot to go with, you know, so Riker and the gang could go do something while Picard is being the mediator. And then all the other stuff as far as Gul Madred. Oh, spoiler. Spoiler, we've already spoiled it now, so maybe we can edit that part out. So, forgot. We don't do spoiler. We do spoiler
it's
warnings here.
It's okay, everybody. So, spoiler warning. I think this is one of those books that the whole premise of the story is so spoilerific. I think it's okay for us to dive into the spoilers because You mentioned Dayton, you know, that
maybe just beep out the word there, Madrid or something.
the whole struggle that Picard has, right? Picard's struggle in this book. One of the things that really struck me was the way in which you were able to bridge the storytelling structures of TNG and Deep Space Nine, which were different, you know, because DS9 really became the show that invested in serialization for its characters, whereas TNG, not as much. You know, there's a little bit, but there's not a ton. And so this, like you said, following Chain of Command, we really get to deal with the fallout for Picard and what that experience had done to him, especially coming face to face once again so soon with his torturer.
That was the allure for me, was what I could do with Picard, because in the series, he goes through that ordeal, and at the end of the episode, it's obvious that he has been affected by it, and it's one of those things that you would assume is going to be an ongoing concern for him, whether we see it or not. And of course, Next Generation being what it was, we didn't. You know, they went on to the next episode and the next storyline, and he's all good to go. You know, he's Picard.
It's like the narrator on Arrested Development, but they didn't.
Right. And, you know, DS9 in its early days wasn't quite ready to lean into, they hadn't started leaning into serialization quite so much. So it was a little more episodic in the first year or so before they really found their legs and realized, you know, where we're going to go once we start doing this thing. I mean, yes, there were some plot arcs they were sewing in, but it was still being approached largely in episodic fashion. So that part didn't concern me so much, but I was more enamored with the opportunity that I could play with Picard and then have him thrown into this situation that's pretty volatile and very fluid at Bajor. And then I also like playing with, you know, Admiral Nechayev, who has at times been very antagonistic toward Picard, but yet at other times she's actually quite amenable, right? And so I just wanted to catch her on a good day, because we know that she's going to catch him, come back and read him the riot act not too long after this episode. So I don't know. It was a lot of fun to be able to just play in that space. And I had never done a Next Generation novel set between any of the episodes of the show. Everything I've done Next Generation, except for one short story, has always been in the post movie time frame or the movie time frame. So it was a interesting challenge to try to find a hole where I could tell a story that didn't seem like just being a gap filler, or, you know,
you mentioned one of the subplots being the Bajorans and the Cardassians went, which were on other planets that the Cardassians controlled. And that subplot seemed to have a lot of the similar themes in something else you'd written, which was Peaceable Kingdoms, the last of the Book of the Fall series, where you also had to deal with the Bajorans and the Cardassians. Did you feel that you were exploring similar themes more in depth, or did you feel like you were able to explore new themes that you hadn't covered before with that subplot?
I was trying to do something different with that. I went back and looked at it because I saw the similarities when I was fleshing out the idea, but I thought, well, I can take this in a different direction. Mm-hmm. It was more about, I think I had read a book or seen a documentary about missing POWs from the Vietnam War and how they may or may not have all been accounted for and how they may or may not still have them there or had them there for many years after the conflict. That's been a topic of discussion. So why wouldn't the Bajorans lie? Uh-huh. I'm sorry. Why wouldn't the Cardassians lie about, you know, we're done with the occupation and we're going to set the Bajorans free and go on about our business? Why would they not lie about that? They lie about everything else. So what would happen if they actually took that step to conceal? I mean, yes, there's always been a German Holocaust victim parallel to the Cardassian Bajoran situation, but I didn't want to lean too heavily into that. But it's obviously there. But I decided to put a little bit more of a different spin on it, or a little different spin on it. I didn't want to lean so overtly into that parallel.
Well, and you mentioning that, you know, I think one of the things that this book does help us to be able to see in a way that, like you mentioned, references other parts of history, but we really do come to see the true evil that the Cardassians perpetrated against the Bajorans, and just how far that evil went. Like, just some of the terrifying ways that it happened. And two, the mindset of the people that can do those things against somebody else. And I loved that this book points out, I think, one of the biggest Cardassian flaws as a society, which is their superiority and their pride. And then it allows them to make everybody less. And just a tool to be used, right? You know, you just kind of treat people as a commodity. And that whole subplot there on that planet was incredibly terrifying and yet really rich for the storyline, because I do think that it just went to show how far the Cardassians had gone, and it's worse than we thought.
Well, I mean, it can always be worse than you think. Yeah. I think history shows us that. I think current events can show us that. There is a great. By the way, I had no intention of being anywhere near as topical as it appears to be. All right, when I wrote the book, a lot of what has happened in the last 6 or 7 months had not happened yet. So not that I'm trying to draft off that or anything, but it was quite alarming to watch, you know, what's unfolded and going, good Lord. But you know, it's not a surprise because our history is rife with that, right? We have always had a group of people who have viewed another group of people as being lesser than or less worthy, or they are to be exploited and tossed aside. That's our human history from the very beginning has always involved that. So yes, the Cardassians can always be worse. And yeah, I was drawing on different bits of history as inspiration, I suppose is the word. But I wasn't intending to draw any overt parallels or make an overt commentary on any one thing. I know that people are going to read the book and come away with their own conclusions, but I promise that was not necessarily my goal going in. But once you start to pick on those threads and pull on them and look for parallels and ways to tell the story, you can't help it. It's just sometimes the story takes on a life of its own and you just sort of hang on for the ride.
Well, and I do think that that's a part of, you know, Deep Space Nine as a whole. You know, it's one of the things that Chris and I have talked a lot about on The Orb, and one of the reasons that we love the show is that the show is written in a way that allows you to be able to pull from so many different places, and it always feels relevant. And part of that is because, you know, I think the things that you're writing about, like you said, it's like, unfortunately, it can always be worse. This is human nature that we're writing, you know, with as our inspiration. And therefore, if we look at our history, it's just rife with this stuff. And that's the unfortunate truth.
Yes, I agree. No, like I said, I don't ever set out necessarily to make overt statements, but you know, I read history and I follow current events and it infects your dreams, for lack of a better term. I mean, it's all a swirl in my head when I'm writing a book. So I will grab onto anything that I think can pull the story or, you know, push the story along, or if I can draw a parallel. And of course, Star Trek, that's what Star Trek does when it does it right. It does it very well. So it's not like I'm not plowing new ground here. Star Trek's always done this sort of thing. As far as DS9, yeah, that show has always been effective when it does that. And so just trying to keep up with the standard that show set was a tall order.
There's a lot of negotiation scenes where you have the Bajorans and the Cardassians on Terek Nor, and you have Picard and the Enterprise crew kind of serving as the mediators. And there was this interesting dynamic where the Bajorans know how terrible the Cardassians are, and the Federation also knows it, but they still have to work with these people. They still have to be civil. They still have to negotiate and sit just across from the people that before were oppressors. There's a lot of deafness in the writing that you had to go into that. Did you have goals when you were writing those scenes and specific plans on how to make them work without being a single side getting too angry at another?
I mean, that was why one of the reasons that I think Picard has always been an effective negotiator and a diplomat is that he's able to kind of set that tone, at least in the times that we've seen him do it on the show. You know, he's been very, like you said, deft. He has been very deft at being able to set a tone for these interactions that where both parties or all parties feel like they can have a voice in what's being done. Yes. At the same time, while everybody is acknowledging the elephant in the room, everybody knows about the elephant in the room, right? These people are horrible, right? But the only way to get them to the table is to make them feel as though they're not being treated like the villains they are. Right. We all know this. So it's like, how do I get a concession out of them? And yet, like Matt said, they are very prideful. You know, they are very, very assured of their place in the cosmos. So how do you stroke all those egos and massage all those feelings and get what you need out of them? Right. It's not quite babysitting, but it's like the next level up, I guess. When you're dealing with a recalcitrant toddler, or if you watch Congress do anything in chambers trying to come up with, you know, it's like that. Maybe not quite so immature, but it was a challenge because, you know, the only examples of Cardassians we have that are the really memorable characters, they're very eloquent. They're very assertive. They're very confident in themselves. They don't view themselves as the villain, right, in their story. So you want to try to channel that. That's to me the only way to make it work is to make it seem like everybody's on the same footing and everybody has something to gain or something to lose. But yet at the same time, we know who the bad guys are in this story. There is no mystery. So yeah, it's I drank a lot.
The life of a writer.
Life of a writer.
You, so one of the things in the book, and this is one of the things that it kind of blew my mind that actually Deep Space Nine really never dealt with this question as a series, which was the inconvenient truth that the Federation hadn't done anything to help the Bajoran people before this, you know, and it really brought to mind that, you know, often attributed to Burke, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And of course, we saw that on display with what the Cardassians did to the Bajorans because nobody came in to help them. And, you know, Deep Space Nine is I think, the best Star Trek show because what it was about challenging the ideals of the Federation and how they actually work out in quote-unquote real life, right? They would take what TNG had kind of created and they would put meat on the bones. And I would love for you to just kind of expound on that because, like, seriously, this I can't believe this is a question that Deep Space Nine really never dealt with as a series. And it seems to me like if I'm the Bajoran people, this is one of my biggest beefs with the Federation in the first place.
I really never liked how Next Generation framed all of that. Like when we get introduced to Ro, you know, Ensign Ro and the plight of the Bajorans for the first time in that episode. And, you know, this is a year after we discovered that there was a whole war with the Cardassians that we knew nothing about for the first 3 or 4 years of the show. Just all of a sudden, oh, by the way, we just finished a war with the Cardassians that we never saw, right?
Flagship not needed in the war. It's fine.
Apparently not. Not the most powerful ship in the fleet. It must be someplace else. It must be the thing about the ship named Enterprise, because you notice that it's like the second or third time they pulled it, right? In different shows. But the idea that the Federation would stand by and let, as a prime directive matter, would not help the Bajorans, even though they're engaged in a war with the very people who are doing this to the Bajorans, it never clicked right for me. I'm like, wait a minute, why can you go to war with these people but not come to the aid of the people they're exploiting to drive your war machine? That never sat well with me, and I never liked the idea. And then DS9 kind of does a hopscotch around that question, you know, as far as how it began, and just picks up with the Bajorans don't trust the Federation because you left us hanging. And then they spend some time dealing with that. So that was what I had to work with as far as Kira and other Bajorans in the storyline was like, you know, these runes are very raw. These wounds are very raw when Picard and the Enterprise come in. It's like, we have no reason to trust you guys. You guys watched us get hammered for all those years and you didn't do a thing. Why are we supposed to trust you now? You know, but the linchpin of that is, I guess the pivot point for that was what happens in Chain of Command, where the Cardassians are going to make that move, but Jellicoe thwarts it. And so that starts pushing them back. And that's what makes the Cardassians decide they're going to pull back and remove themselves from Bajor and other planets, allows the Federation to come in. It's not explicitly said in the show, but you can draw the line. So that's what I tried to do. I hope it works.
No, I think it does.
That's what I had to work with. So I'm just like, well, I'm going to have to connect. I'm going to have to invent a few dots to include in the connecting process and hope it works.
Well, it totally does, because Chris and I had just recorded an episode of The Orb that'll be out in a few weeks on Duet. And I referenced this book in that, and we talk about this idea because it has to be there, like, because, you know, the Federation hadn't stepped in 50 years while this is happening. You know, they know this is going on, and so
they may not have known at the beginning that it was going on, but they knew about it at some point. And now you could argue there's actually now on-screen evidence that suggests the Federation knew about the Cardassians and knew about Bajor, you know, well in advance of, because there's a reference in, is it Strange New Worlds that talks about Bajor and Cardassians?
It does, which
I don't remember. It's just a throwaway. Yeah. It's like a throwaway reference. If you blink, you miss it. And I'm just like, I don't think they were supposed to know about them that early, but oops, it's canon now.
Yeah.
So, you know, another monkey wrench in the machinery. But yeah, that part that never set well with me. And I went back and forth with different episodes that I thought were relevant to the whole thing. And I'm like, okay, I can see where the line is drawn, maybe, but it still doesn't set well. The idea that the Federation would do nothing while fully aware of what's going on and call it a prime directive matter, that's one of those cop-out things for me. The prime directive is a cop-out in a lot of episodes for me.
And I mean, there is historical precedent in the sense of the United States trying to stay out of World War One and Two for so long, it wasn't our problem, you know. And I think that there's a good historical precedent there, but at the same time, and this is, you know, one of those things with Star Trek too, and it's one of the conundrums I end up having with Picard. It's like the show. There are things that happen there. It's like, you guys really still haven't learned your lesson. You're supposed to be these advanced utopia like people, and we still are having the same exact issues. And it's just, it's mind boggling. But I mean, it's not as though there isn't historical precedent for that.
And it's not as though the Bajorans were this primitive society either.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, it's like they weren't cave dwellers. They were a fully functional, wonderful, advanced, artistically advanced society that was all that was destroyed, or a lot of it was destroyed during the occupation. Like I said, there are good things about the Prime Directive, and there have been some great episodes where we see the virtue of the Prime Directive. But I've always felt in this instance it was a cop out. Because, like, how do you stand by as an arbiter of, you know, personal freedom and liberty and all that, and watch that go down? And yes, there are absolutely historical parallels to what the United States did during the first world, you know, the first two world wars. The two world wars. Let's hope. Let's not push our luck for a third.
Let's not birth that into existence.
Yeah, I mean, and it was, you know, we didn't learn our lesson there either, you know, so. We can talk about, that's a whole other topic that we could spend all day going into, but yeah, just that part bugged me. And I really wanted to come up with something that made sense in story that acknowledged it, didn't ignore it. And that, you know, makes the Federation basically have to stand up and go, yeah, we screwed that one. We dropped that ball big time. And now is our chance to try to make right. And yes, the Bajorans are not going to trust us for quite some time, if ever, but this is the beginning of that process, you know, the first step on that journey. You look like your hand up.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. The first, you know, the big part of the book is the big themes, but you also have some smaller character journeys in the book as well. And one character journey I really appreciated was the O'Briens. And I thought it was so fascinating to explore why he took the job, and also to explore why she would be so, you know, willing to have such a quick change of venue for them. And you explore that reasoning here. Did you have a lot to pull from the show or other materials, or did you get to include some of that reasoning yourself?
Well, the show doesn't really give us a reason why he changes jobs. You know, I mean, not really. I mean, so the idea, I guess, is he was just fascinated by the opportunity. And, you know, there's those early episodes where Keiko was really having a hard time acclimating to the new gigs, right? So my experience as former military, having to have uproot my wife and make her come with me to another duty station, not once, but twice, okay, in a very short period of time, I drew on that experience, because that was not a difficult, or that was not an easy discussion to have. That was not an easy transition. She did go through a period where she was not sure what she was going to do, or if this was the life she wanted, you know, because she has her own goals. She had her own ideas about what she wanted to accomplish. And I was getting in the way of that, me and Uncle Sam, right? So I tried to start that way, but I didn't want it to be quite so pat, like, well, you know, Starfleet gave me orders and I have to go. That felt like a cop out. So I really wanted it to be a journey for O'Brien to basically tap into his unrealized potential. You know, because we've seen him and all he does is man the transporter console. Then you come to find out he's got all this backstory on DS9, right? And you're like, wait a minute. Why would he just do what he did on the Enterprise if he could do all the things that we now see him doing on DS9? There has to be a story there, right? And so that's why I invented the whole bit about, you know, he's hands on. He likes, you know, he leads his team from the front. He's the first one to get his hands dirty. He's that's why he remains an enlisted person instead of taking a commission. Those things appeal to me from a military standpoint or based on my career. And then the idea that Keiko would support him after he explains his position to her, after he explains what he's looking for, because he was thinking about retiring. I mean, I had him at one point where he was might hang it up and they'd all go home. You know, but because he's, you know, and in theory, he wouldn't be out of line, because if you do the math, he's close to 30 years in Starfleet anyway. I mean, so it's like, well, I mean, that's when most people retire in this day and age after that long. So what would motivate him to do to make the transition? It's like, well, it's the technical challenge. And it's the idea that he's being called upon to, you know, to take on much more responsibility than he's ever been asked to do, at least that we've seen on camera at this point. And then I think that's what to me made the most sense for a character like him, the challenge and the change of scenery. And at the time, the idea that it was a more stable environment for a young child versus sailing off into danger every week, you know, because what's going to happen on a space station? You know, nobody's going to come and bother us here. What could possibly go wrong? So it's not like we're going to have a war right on our front porch, right?
I think, and this is, as I was kind of saying earlier, one of the things that this storyline with the O'Briens and specifically Miles represents to me is, again, you know, DS9 was the show that I think really found the potential of all the storytelling plot points that TNG had laid out, but just never really used in the way that right. we would have liked to have seen. And this is, I loved the way O'Brien is actually the microcosm of this larger meta point about what Deep Space Nine does for the Star Trek universe. You know, I think the depth of the Star Trek universe actually really comes and only is there because of Deep Space Nine. You know, I think all of the other shows, even the ones that we're seeing on now, you know, they kind of owe everything to what Deep Space Nine did with the universe of Star Trek and really fleshing it out with these characters, you know, trying to create less of a monoculture of every culture that we knew, trying to make characters feel more real and just yeah. have real lives. And the way you wrote the O'Briens here is, I think, very much the way that we see them in the show, which is they feel like an actual real married couple. Like anybody that's been married recognizes that relationship because it feels like your own marriage.
I thank you. I mean, that was what I was gunning for, is it's, you know, it's a lot like my own marriage, you know, the demands that my work placed on my wife at that point in time, early in our, because it was a young marriage at that time, similar to what the O'Briens had. So I was trying to channel a bit of that. You know, write what you know, right? But you're right. As far as DS9, I wonder if, you know, I honestly don't know if it's true, but I, you know, you look at a lot of the episodes in DS9, especially when they started to really actively try to break the mold of Star Trek storytelling. It's like, well, you know, this is what we would have done if we were on Next Gen.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go the other way. You know, it's like they would expect us to do this if it was Picard and the gang. So we're going to go do this instead. And I don't know if it was deliberate. I don't know if it was an act of rebellion or they just decided that this was the place, since they're not paying attention to us. You know, they're paying attention to Next Generation wrapping mm-hmm. up, and now they're paying attention to Voyager over on UPN, and they're kind of leaving us alone. We're going to experiment a little bit and see what happens. And it's not always going to win. And they and what I love about DS9, I don't know if you've ever read the DS9 companion book that Terry Erdman wrote. It's like, you know, I love the fact that the writers were not afraid to say, well, we tried that and it didn't work. You know, they didn't make excuses about how the audience didn't understand what we were going for, or they didn't have enough budget or whatever. They would flat out tell you, sounded good on paper, you know, and I love that candid response to that kind of thing. And so that to me, that's DS9. They're not afraid to take a shot, not afraid to fail. Right. But we're going to pick ourselves up and we're going to try again. That just seems to be a running theme throughout the show.
There were quite a lot of DS9 characters who were able to pop in and show up. And you talked about the trying to figure out how to incorporate them properly, because you had certain ones that just couldn't show up because they hadn't been there yet on Terraknor. And then you had other characters that it would make sense to see. So we see Odo and Quark and Kira in this book. And of course, some of the Cardassians. Did you have certain characters that you wanted to see them interact with that you hadn't seen them interact with before when you were writing the book?
I wanted to play with, he's on the cover, so I can't spoil him. I wanted to play a little bit with Garrick, but I knew that I could only go so far. You know, that was the other thing, being based on where I set the story, I could only go so far. So the question is, all right, my perimeter is very tight. So what can I do within that area? You know, how far can I push it? How far can I play with it? How much fun can I have with it? So, you know, Odo harassing Garrick was on my list of things to do. Having at least one good Quark scene, you know, was on my list of things to do. I had to find a way to work Morn in there at least a couple of times. I think he shows up twice. And it seems like he's in the same spot every time, which is the gag, right? That's the running gag. So I had to find a way to call out that gag. Kira was probably the one that I had the most fun with because you start to see her transformation, but yet she's still the angry rebel when we meet her in Emissary. And then, you know, there's a few other folks that get peppered in there, but yeah, it was like, I can only push the boundary so far, but I'm going to have a little bit of fun and try to establish the antagonistic relationship between Quark and Odo, and between Quark and Garrick, I'm going to say Odo and Garrick, because we all know what's coming. That's the other thing. It's like, we all know what's going to happen because of the show. So it's like, how can I set that up, but not overplay my hand, not reach too far into what's been established and act like I'm repeating myself. Or act like I'm just drafting off the show and just rewriting a scene that you're going to see in an episode. Like, how do I make that different? So that was kind of fun. That was a problem I created for myself by setting the story where I did. So, I mean, I probably could have pushed hard and asked them to let me set it on the Enterprise-Z and have a later DS9 episode crossover, but it was more fun once I started playing with the Picard angle.
Yeah, no, I think one of the things that you did, I think it was the perfect setting because you have the natural connection with Picard's experience with the Cardassians so recently, and the, you know, handover then of Bajor to the Bajorans, the call for Federation help. Then I think, you know, all of that works timeline wise, and then I think, like you said, just finding those connecting dots that just kind of help make this feel very fluid. As if this was an episode or, you know, a two-part episode.
Or as close to,
you know, yeah, yeah. I think that's the thing that you know, I've said so many times, like, this is exactly what you want from tie-in fiction, which is that it's a story that you read and then it forever alters the way in which you watch the episodes. You know, so I'll never be able to watch Chain of Command the same way, and I'll never be able to watch Emissary the same way, because I'll always be thinking of this book. And that's exactly what a good tie-in writer like yourself can do, is truly enhance the experience of the show moving forward forever.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that. That's very kind of you to say. I mean, it's a fine line between filling in a gap in the continuity and writing a throwaway book that doesn't have any consequence. And a lot of tie-in sometimes falls into that latter category. Yeah. by necessity or by design or even, mm-hmm, by decree. You know, like, the license owner doesn't want you to make bold swings, right, with their character. They want you to tell a safe story that sits between two stakes in the ground and you do not wander off the path. Luckily, Star Trek has always been a little bit more tolerant, you know, until they create new TV series that undo everything. But that's a whole other question. So, not that I have any knowledge or experience with that.
No.
So whenever I write an original series novel that's set during the show or between the films, you know, I try to find something new that you haven't seen with those characters. But yet at the same time, I know that there are limits how far I can push things, such as the case here. I mean, yeah, but the idea was, like, you know, I'd like to tell a story that matters. You know, it's the story that should have been told by somebody else, but they never got around to it. So I'm going to do it. And to me, the big nugget there was Picard and his post-traumatic stress. That was the juicy part. And so everything else was me finding reasons to be able to flesh out everybody else around him and have their stories while I entertaining that very tasty morsel of untold storytelling that I wanted to do.
With one of the big parts of the storyline, though, becomes something that, you know, a show that you're very familiar with allowed you to introduce something to the series and utilize, which was the ocean side and the crew on the ocean side, the people that were on there, some familiar faces that we've seen before.
Familiar faces.
And so I just love to hear you just talk about the joy of kind of getting to utilize something. You have had so much to do with Lower Decks. And so how fun was it to be able to then insert that into this book?
I kind of did it on a whim. I mean, not a whim. I mean, it was in my outline. I said, I'd like to have a Cerritos or a California class ship involved. You know, I don't know why. I just felt like it would be the right thing to do now that we know that they exist and what they do. So as far as populating certain characters or using certain characters, you know, despite the fact that we had to turn off the literary universe that we had created for the novels over all those years, we still have a lot of characters out there that can be repurposed. You know, we could take them on a different track in this reality. So, you know, the idea that here there's Dr. Trop, that guy that we had on the Enterprise Z for a long time, you know, now he's on the ocean side. And the reason I named it ocean side is because my first duty station was Camp Pendleton, California, and the nearest town is Oceanside, right outside the back gate. So, or I saw the front gate, so I had to go there. But it was fun to bring in characters that the longtime readers of the novels would recognize, even if I portray them slightly differently in keeping with this continuity. So it was kind of fun. It's like, well, why create a whole bunch of new characters when we can just go in and grab a couple of those SCE guys, you know, or guys from our other novels? It was a shortcut. But it was also fun because I wanted to see how long it would take people to recognize character X from, you know, another book or another short story.
Yeah, that's really fun. Well, and two, I think, you know, kind of doing a less, you know, funny version of the idea of the California class ship. It actually really works. The idea that there's this whole class of ship that their job is to, you know, do the second context, to go in and then formalize that relationship that's been created by those exploratory vessels, and that they're made, you know, specifically to be kind of overpowered so that they have the ability to help in, you know, drastic situations. And I think that was the beauty of it, that and one of the things that I've personally loved about Lower Decks is that, as silly as it is, it actually kind of takes the idea of Star Trek very seriously and its core, and that's what actually makes it work, right? And so this really just showed the validity of, you can strip away the silly part of it, and it actually is a show and an idea that makes complete sense.
I agree. I mean, I'm like you. I think when you boil away the jokes and the silliness on Lower Decks, you know, at its heart it's still Star Trek. And you see that in episode after episode, you know, there's still a legitimate Star Trek style problem that they have to fix, mm-hmm. or deal with. And they do it. They knuckle down and they do it. Even though there might be wisecracking before and after all that, the core of that story is still pretty Star Trek. And I've said it before about that group of writers, you know, from Mike McMahon down. It's like they are pound for pound some of the biggest Star Trek fans and most knowledgeable Star Trek fans I've run into who work on the shows. You can't joke about Star Trek the way they do if you don't know the material, you know, and intimately, not just, you know, what you read on Memory Alpha or pulled from the encyclopedia or whatever. These people are black belt nerds in Star Trek. I've witnessed it firsthand. It's amazing. They don't know everything, but they know where to look. And if they don't know where to look, then they know who to email, you know? So I've had some very weird, deep, odd conversations about various little arcane bits of Star Trek lore with these guys while they work on different episodes. And it's kind of surreal sometimes. So Like, for example, we're going to find out this year what Cardassian feet look like when they don't have their boots on.
Oh,
so, that was an actual conversation.
That
what do Cardassian feet look like? I'm like, good, I honestly don't know.
It's a great question, actually.
So we had to go. It was an honest to God conversation. I swear to God.
Another example of I didn't know we needed that.
Exactly. And I don't know. Lower Decks is going to make you feel like it's been a missing component of your life, right? So it's just, but I mean, they were just so much fun to work with because, you know, again, once you get past the jokes and the silliness, they really were hardcore Star Trek. They really are Star Trek fans to the core. So it was fun to do that. And, you know, take out the silliness part because that wouldn't work in a Next Generation novel. So how do I portray a crew of a ship like this in a next gen manner, right? or that era manner, and do it justice.
I do have one technical question on the design of the book. I also asked when we talked to David Mack about his in the book when I was reading it. I noticed when we got to quarks, when we got capital Q's, the curl on the Q,
the little tilde thing, the little curly thing,
really long. And I thought, I don't think I've ever seen that before in a Star Trek book. Maybe I just missed it. So the question for you is, was that intentional or was that something that just happened with the font design?
Came with the font design. When I started seeing the typeset pages and I was like, well, that's odd. So, and I don't know that I've ever noticed that before. I'd have to go back and look. I didn't go back and look at the time because I was just so pressed for time trying to get everything in on time. I don't know if that's something they've always done or more recently done or just, you know, the designer this time decided to do it. I honestly can't tell you. I will ask, though, because I had forgotten about it until you brought it up. I mean, I just got my copies like a week or so ago and I flipped through them real quick just to make sure none of the pages were upside down or whatever. Just to make sure it worked okay.
Are we sure that Quark hadn't just paid a little extra latinum to have his name be
very
bigger than everybody else's?
I'm surprised they didn't italicize it like a brand. Yeah. I mean, we're early now. He hasn't franchised yet.
Exactly.
So, at least in my mind. He doesn't franchise out Quark's Bar until after this series, exactly. In my mind.
Well, it was, I was going to say, it wasn't noticeable as much because there's not many words that start with Q, the letter Q in this book, but the one word that is frequently used is Quark. And so I only noticed it when his name came up.
I saw it when I was going through the page, like, man, it's the only letter that has that. Just like, I don't know. It must be the font because I'm not a font guy, so I can't tell you what font that is. You'd have to ask somebody more versed in that. But yeah, it was definitely noticeable because I know I would go past it and then I would back up. Well, okay. That's a thing that we're going to do, I guess.
It's funny, you know? Because Jonathan, you say that and Dayton, you talk about it. I actually went to look to see if, you know, sometimes books tell you what the typeset is. And I couldn't find it anywhere because I was also looking.
Sometimes they put it on the inside of the title page or maybe even on the back cover. It just depends on the publisher. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't know if that's even in there. He's got a copy of it right there. So
I'm looking. I know that the Star Wars books from Del Rey and now Random House Worlds have a very specific typeset that they use now. Mm-hmm. That's Minion. And I will never forget that because I thought it was so unique. But yeah, that they do not have that anywhere I can find it, at least.
Are we sure that's not French and it's Mignon?
What I need to do is go back and look at like the book I did last year and see if it's the same
thing. Right.
It's a good point.
I don't recall. I mean, it could be something that got introduced when they moved to trade paperbacks versus the mass markets. And I just haven't known because like you said, it's Q and how many words start with capital Q unless it's Queen. And that actually the last book I did, the Discovery book, would probably be a good check because, you know, Queen, Poe and all that. So let me, now I have a mission. Okay. I have a homework assignment. All right.
You didn't know where you're getting homework tonight. I have a question to and wanted to hear you talk about the end of the book, the very fitting end that we get. And I couldn't have been more happy with the way that this book ends because it's very similar to a very popular Deep Space Nine episode, and it gives us a real insight into just who that Garak character really is. And I was, I was overjoyed with that choice of an ending, especially for that character.
I'm surprised they let me get away with it. I mean, I guess we're moving into spoiler
territory
now.
Absolute spoilers here.
Okay, so, you know, I wrote that in the outline that this is going to happen, and then, you know, this is going to set the tone for the relationship between Odo and Garak for sure. If I haven't already done it, then this is going to cement the tone, at least going into the series. They didn't bat an eye. Paramount didn't say a word. Simon & Schuster didn't say a word. They're like, okay, yeah, he's a prick. He deserves to die. maybe not those words, but that was the sentiment. It was like, yeah, swing, go ahead. The death itself was not anything that I really took a lot of joy in. It was just the idea that Garak would do that. Garak would take that swing, and Odo knows he did it. Garrick's not going to admit he did it, but Odo knows he did it. So now these guys are going to be watching each other from now on. And, you know, and all it does is fuel a fire. Is, you know, is Garak really an outcast, or is he just, you know, pretending to be an outcast? Being an agent, we don't know. And also, I made a deliberate decision to have it happen after Picard leaves station. He's not involved in that in any way, shape, or form. He has no knowledge of it, no influence. He's not affected by it. I don't even know when he might find out that Madred goes, you know. I didn't even think about that. It was more about, I wanted to leave the book basically handing it off to DS9 right before Emissary kicks. And to me, that felt like the best way to do it, was to have those last two scenes take place on the station. You know, the next gen part of the story's over, and we're transitioning toward DS9. So that's why I set those two scenes the way I did.
That's really funny, that because this seems really believable to me, because I'm a teacher, and just today I had an example where I had a student do something, and I know that the student did it. I can't prove it, but I know that they did it. And so we had a conversation, and I was like, I'm going to be watching because I know you did it. I just don't have proof yet that you did. And so we had a very similar dynamic. I mean, this, what the student did wasn't as bad as what Garak did. Whew. But still,
hopefully not.
No, yeah. Not that bad. But still, I was like, this is realistic. This dynamic between a character who's like the rule enforcer and the person who's like the spy who's trying to get away with something.
I mean, Garak is not a nice guy. We know this, right? I mean, he can be a nice guy, but fundamentally, he's very deep, dark, evil, right? I mean, he's not evil, but he's capable of evil. He's been trained to inflict evil and just not have any passion about it whatsoever. It's the job, right? So the idea that he would do that, to me, was never a question. It's like, of course he would do that. I mean, he's going to do much worse when the show kicks into gear. I mean, that's nothing compared to what he's going to do later. We know this, right? This was for me, it was just a mild way of reminding people, Garak's a dick, but he's a dick worth watching. He's going to be fun. You know?
And I do think that, and the beauty that I see in this and the strangeness of this is, like, Garak is such a complicated character. And yet at the same time, what we see throughout the series is that Garak truly does want what's best for Cardassia.
He does.
And I think that we see him in this moment that Madred is not what's best for Cardassia. In fact, Cardassians like him have made it terrible. And so his actions here are so much and as you were kind of talking about this whole idea of, like, you know, villains don't necessarily see themselves as, you know, villains.
No.
And so Garak I think he sees himself as doing what's best for the Cardassia, and whether or not, like, it's good, or he should have done it, or whatever, is not really a question to him. He's doing what he thinks is right for Cardassia. And
he's a very complicated character, like you said. And he's a very rich character. I mean, there's a lot to play with, and depending on every way you want to go. I mean, I jokingly call him, you know, he's a dick, and he comes off that way. But you're right; he's motivated by what is best for his people. And that's what leads him to his decision, you know, during the Dominion War, the things that he did. And I think, as like you said, the best villains, even, you know, technically Garrick would not be a villain, but the best villains are always the heroes of their own story. They believe they're doing the right thing for the right reasons, you know, and you can't convince them otherwise. They're not mustache twirlers. They are fundamentally, you know, invested in whatever their goal is because they think it's going to bring about a positive change through their lens. So that's Garrick. That's absolutely Garrick. I mean, and that pays off as the series progresses and as his arc continues. And then we get to the end of the show with, you know, where he ends up. It's like, yeah, that's totally consistent. But yeah, he's just not afraid to take the big swing or, you know, do the dark thing that most people would be balking at. Like, well, that's a bit too far, don't you think? Nah, I'll do it. Because he sees a bigger picture. May not be the picture everybody else is painting, but it's definitely a bigger picture.
Mm. Before we let you go, always want to give you, just a platform to let people know what's coming up, what you've got coming out, what you may be working on that you could tell us about, where, and of course, where people can find you so that they can see when those announcements come out.
Well, I mean, this book is coming out Tuesday. The next thing I've got coming out is my next collaboration with Kevin Dillmore, my writing partner, my longtime writing partner and my best friend. We did another one of those Marvel Declassified books for Ben Bella. This one is going to take a deep dive into Captain America, Steve Rogers. So it is the third of that Declassified series that Ben Bella Books has been putting out over the last several months. We had Iron Man come out in November. That was Kevin and mine. That was our first time working with Marvel. Maurice Broaddus, who's a very notable writer, took on the challenge of digging into T'Challa, you know, Black Panther. Then we're back in the saddle with Captain America, and a fourth book is on the way. Has not been announced yet, and neither has the writer. So I'll leave that for Ben Bella to. But I'm thrilled with the choice of writer and the character that individual is writing about. So I think it's a perfect fit. So I can't wait for them to make that announcement so we can all celebrate this person's accomplishment. The next thing that I'm doing is I just recently finished a short story for an anthology that the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers is doing for their annual, you know, we're doing basically public domain tie-in type writing. So it's all twists on Sherlock Holmes. I basically reinvented Sherlock Holmes and Watson as military investigators on the moon.
Nice. That's awesome.
It's like NCIS meets Outland.
That's awesome.
So Watson is the grizzled veteran who's ready to retire, and Holmes is the up and coming young probie with, you know, who's got potential and is a woman, by the way. So just for fun. And then I've got some work I'm going on for a couple of, it was announced that I did some work for the Planet of the Apes role playing game. That's getting ready to do a Kickstarter for its crowdfunding effort. I'm doing some more work with Star Trek Adventures that will be announced later on in the year. And a couple other gaming related projects that I can't talk about just yet. They keep me busy though. And then I'm still doing the consulting thing with Paramount. So they keep me busy.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, we were just talking about, we've got the Starfleet Academy show that they're doing. We've got more Strange New Worlds coming up. And then of course with, the end of Lower Decks coming soon. We're just kind of wondering what they're going to do next. So, you know, hopefully maybe some Star Trek Legacy or something like that.
You know, they're filming Strange New Worlds. I know they've written all the scripts for the 10 episodes. I don't know which one they're filming right now. And there's always modifications and reshoots to everything. So it doesn't really matter which one's done. They are writing Starfleet Academy. I have read up to 107 out of 10, episode 7 out of 10 for the first season. Interesting show. Going to be a little different than what you've seen so far. Some familiarity things, some old, some new things. It'll be interesting. Interesting roster of characters you're going to see. Then there's Section 31, the movie event they've created for Paramount Plus. I have seen a trailer for that. that did not include music or visual effects, and it looks pretty intense, to be perfectly honest. Can't give you any details other than I was impressed by what they were able to pull off. Can't wait to see a finished trailer, and can't wait to see it, you know, mixed with sound and visual effects and music, everything. Michelle Yeoh owns every scene she's in, as is always the case, it seems. As far as what's next, they've got ideas bandied about. There's the whiteboard of dreams is in there apparently. No idea what might be next.
Well, that's great and exciting. Hopefully, we'll get some good stuff coming up. But you know, as always, Dayton, and as we mentioned at the top of the show, you helped launch the show, and it's just phenomenal that we've been able to continue to have you on, because they've continued to let you write books. And you know, this was just an absolute banger. And so hopefully we'll have more Star Trek books coming from you in the future, because honestly, it just feels like it wouldn't really be Literary Treks without Dayton.
I appreciate that. You know, I'll keep doing it as long as they keep calling me. It's definitely a weird job, and not the one I envisioned. My as I've said before, my guidance counselor from high school definitely owes me an apology.
Were they like, never will be a writer?
Well, you know, that Star Trek stuff. Stop wasting your time on that Star Trek stuff. It's never going to amount to anything. And my mother, you know, I can't believe they paid to write that crap.
Career preparation, all those days, you know, watching TV.
Like, it's my mom's fault. She's the one who bought the first comic books and stuff. But no, I mean, I've been very fortunate, and I'm very aware of that. Or at least I definitely take steps to remind myself of that very frequently, that it's been quite a journey, and you know, and not one that everybody gets to do. And I've been very privileged to do it. And I hopefully I can keep doing right by it, you know, and they'll call me at least one more time. Let's see what happens.
So. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being here.
No, thanks for having me. It's always fun.
Well, it was great getting to talk about all those spoilers with Dayton. Man, he had a lot of spoilers ready, and we did too. And it's always fun to be able to fully talk about a book, not just hint at everything that happened in it.
No, I agree with you. I mean, if you're going to have the author on, you know, the creator of the book on, I don't think there's any reason to beat around the bush when it comes to spoilers. And, you know, this book just had so many great things for us to be able to talk about. And, you know, Jonathan, I think we mentioned as we were talking to Dayton, but my true hope is whatever they do with Star Trek books, there are plenty of these type of stories to be able to do for The Next Generation, I think, for Deep Space Nine, even for Voyager. And so I would love to see them really mine the depths of these shows and find those connection points where they can truly make something special like Pliable Truths is.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the feeling I got reading this book was the same feeling I got reading the DS9 Revenant book that we got a couple years ago by Alex White, which was that book told a story set during the shows that I thought, man, I'm going to look at the shows differently and I appreciate them. And then, of course, we're getting other books coming out that serve an entirely different function, like Firewall, which was meant to fill in gaps after the this era of shows. And so it's nice that the people at Gallery are really showing us variety, not just in terms of, you know, which show we're following, but in terms of what style of story we're able to get. Right. And they're able to fill all of those types.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more, man. Well, hey, if you know, people wanted to catch up with you, though, and see what else you've got going on, where would be the place for them to look?
You can contact me on my Twitter, which is at Jonathan Cohn. I have my YouTube channel, which is my name, Jonathan Cohn, where I talk all things books. And then I also have Goodreads, which is also my name, Jonathan Cohn. And then if you're interested in Star Wars at all, I do a Star Wars podcast called Two Sons of Tatooine.
Awesome, man. And of course, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Outside of Literary Treks here on the network, you can find me doing the 602 Club, which talks about all of those franchises outside of Star Trek. And then doing The Orb, Warp 5, Saddle Up, and The Artificial Tango. And then outside of the TFM network, you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network. One completed show there called Owlpost, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then you can find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.